Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long haul truck, RV, camper, taxi. Your parents' well-appointed paneled rec room. Maybe you have an air hockey table down there. Your loft. That greasy spoon just off the interstate. And your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. And tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010. Last night I mentioned that News Talk 1010, the old CFRB, had been on the radio for 80 years. Correction, it's more like 90. 90 years. Also last night, or should I say earlier this morning, during the open line segment, a number of callers shared their near-death experiences or glimpses of an afterlife. Tonight, in hour one, I'm revisiting the topic of the afterlife, this time an alleged after-death communication involving the great American magician escape artist Harry Houdini. Houdini and his wife Bess were fierce debunkers of psychic ability, mediums, and the spiritualist movement. In fact, Houdini wrote several books exposing fake mediums and their fraudulent methods. Houdini, of course, died of a ruptured appendix on October the 31st, 1926, Halloween, 4 days after receiving 4 unexpected punches to his abdomen by a McGill University student backstage at the Princess Theatre in Montreal, Canadian connection there. On his deathbed, Houdini allegedly told doctors that despite being a skeptic of after-death communication, if he were able to get a message to his beloved wife Bess, he would do so. Then, more than 2 years after his death, his wife Bess attended a séance conducted by medium psychic Arthur Ford, during which Ford allegedly channeled a message from Harry using a secret coded message previously agreed to by Harry and Bess. Initially, Bess stated publicly in a signed and witnessed testimony that she believed Harry had in fact communicated to her from the grave. Later, however, she recanted and stated publicly that no, Harry had not communicated to her during the séance. Despite this, Bess continued to hold highly publicized séances in New York every Halloween on the anniversary of Harry's death for the next 10 years. During all that time, she said she received no communication from Harry. Finally, after the last séance on October 31st, 1936, Bess gave up, saying, 10 years is long enough to wait for any man. Thomas Rossetto is a writer and a passionate seeker of truth on a lifelong spiritual quest. More than 10 years ago, Thomas wrote an article which he posted online titled, Houdini's Afterlife Experiment. Did it work? In it, he argues it's quite possible Houdini did communicate from the grave during a séance held in January of 1929. He'll be here in hour one to explain how the secret coded method worked, whether it was possible for the psychic medium Arthur Ford to have known about it in advance, and why Bess Houdini would later recant her story and deny she had ever received such a message. Did the great escape artist Harry Houdini escape death? We'll discuss that in moments. In hours 2, 3, and 4, author Steve Ubaney was on Coast with me back in August to discuss his explosive and controversial book, Who Murdered Elvis Presley, in which he painstakingly lays out the evidence that the King of Rock and Roll was likely murdered in his bathroom at Graceland by an assassin hired by the mob with the tacit approval of Presley's longtime manager, the corrupt and abusive and controlling Colonel Tom Parker. Well, Steve is back tonight this morning for 3 hours to discuss the findings of his latest in his Who Murdered series. This time, Ubaney re-examines the death of the United States' 32nd president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. For nearly 75 years, we have bought into the narrative that Roosevelt died of a massive cerebral hemorrhage in April of 1945 at his retreat in Warm Springs, Georgia, known as the Little White House. Ubaney wants you to put your thinking caps on tonight and ask yourselves, why were FDR's medical records stolen and destroyed? He asks, are we really expected to believe that FDR died of natural causes at the same time Allied troops were closing in on Hitler's bunker? Are we really expected to believe that Roosevelt, Hitler, and Mussolini died within 18 days by coincidence? What was discovered deep in the archive under more than 70 years of dust will shock you. Who murdered FDR? The true story they don't want you to know. Again, that's hours 2, 3, and 4. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Welcome back. Thomas Rossetto is one of the freshest voices offering some of the clearest guidance on enlightenment and spiritual awakening. Thomas digs deeply into these subjects to reveal their core wisdom in simple, clear English. The first time Thomas heard this wisdom was when he attended one of Timothy Conway's satsang in the summer of 2005. Thomas has taught a class based on the satsang for the Center for Lifelong Learning. He's spoken publicly numerous times, both in person and on the radio. And in September 2012, he spoke for the prestigious lecture series Mind and Supermind, which is run by the SBCC. Graham Hancock selected Thomas as his author of the month for March 2012 and again for August 2014. He is the author of Living the Paradox of Enlightenment and his article, Houdini's Afterlife Experiment, Did It Work? Thomas Rossetto, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm well, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Let's talk about Harry Houdini's, how should we describe this? I mean, he was not just a skeptic of after-death communication. He was an avowed debunker, and I don't even think that is saying it strongly enough. I mean, there was almost a hatred for these people that he considered to be frauds. Where did that happen? Why did that happen? How did it come about?
That's a very interesting place to start, because you're absolutely right. I mean, he wrote two books, as you mentioned, and he really was not just on the side. His mother died in 1913, and at that point he tried to get in touch with her through some psychics, but he could tell they were all faking what they were doing. And so that kind of got him going. And so as an excellent magician, he was able to replicate some of the things that these fake mediums would do. So he was always looking for that. And actually, I think this is ultimately what got him killed, because I think that the people, these fake psychics, were talking amongst themselves. And I think they wanted to rough him up a little bit. I don't think they wanted to kill him. But I think they wanted to say, hey, back off, man. We don't get in your way. Get out of our way. And I think they might have spent some money to get that that young student who had been on the boxing team to punch him in the stomach, which was a trick he did in public. And as you know, Richard, he would pick someone out of the crowd. He'd pick someone like you or me, you know?
Right.
And he would have them come up to the stage, and he would make his muscles ready, and he would be ready for that. But this time, this guy came backstage, and Harry wasn't expecting it at all. His muscles weren't firm. This guy really laid into him, and the trauma into his abdomen was so intense that, you know, he had those problems, and his appendix burst, and this is why he passed away.
Right, and had he gone to the doctor immediately to receive medical help, he probably would have lived, but always the showman, the show must go on. He went on and he performed four or five more shows and then finally collapsed in Detroit.
Yes, he was doing little tiny handkerchief magic because that was all he had the strength for. But one other point on this subject about these fake mediums, he would send his assistants out and they would find these people and they would see the show and he would find a point in time where the show could be busted, so to speak. And he would even get the guy that was in control of the lights in on the deal. And Harry would show up with a photographer from a newspaper. Harry would be wearing a disguise. The magician would be in the middle of his, you know, his seance or whatever, with a hidden string making something fly through the sky or whatever, and the lights would come up and the photographer would take a picture and the fake medium would be totally surprised, and he'd say, "Who are you?" And he'd say, "I'm Harry Houdini," and he'd pull off his mask. And so these guys were very upset at him.
Fascinating. I had not heard the theory that perhaps some of these, a cabal of of disgruntled psychics and mediums had put this young student at McGill University up to the task of
disrupting him.
Beating on Harry, right?
Just roughing him up. That's my own idea. I haven't heard it from anyone else.
Right.
It seems to make sense. A few phone calls. Hey, you know, I mean,
so,
that guy had nothing on Harry. You know, I mean, he didn't have any kind of reason to go there or do anything.
Right.
Anyway,
right. I just wanted to ask you, but briefly, about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, because they were Harry and he were good friends, and yet Doyle was a prominent spiritualist. So how did that friendship survive the fact that Harry was such an avowed debunker, didn't have time for spiritualists, and yet his good friend and his wife were both very much into the spiritualist movement?
Yes, yes. The spiritualist movement is not exactly defined in some kind of permanent structure. You know, you can't say there's a leader. But a lot of people did look to Doyle as the leader of the spiritualist. And they had a friendship starting in around 1920 for about 2 years. And I think their friendship came about through fame, just fame, crossing paths and, hey, how are you? And they enjoyed the fact that they had a different perspective, and they talked about it. But eventually, there was a little bit of discord between them that got so much that they did break off their friendship after a couple of years. It was Doyle's wife who gave a automatic writing kind of reading for Harry, where she claims that she brought through Harry's mother. And Harry's mother, the spirit of Harry's mother, plays an important part in this whole thing. And Harry was supposedly moved, but he declined to acknowledge any real evidence that there was contact. And that kind of upset Doyle and his wife, and that was the beginning of the tension. So anyway.
Because he sort of outed her in public, didn't he? Didn't he out her,
yes.
Doyle's wife,
some
in public?
This,
yeah.
Yes, yes. Sorry to talk over you. Some of this did play out through the newspaper, which is an awkward way to have a conversation.
Now part of this debunking that Harry and Bess engaged in would be to sort of demonstrate, I guess, to audiences how it worked. So they would sort of do their own sort of faux psychic act on stage. And I don't know if they then explained to the audience, you know, how they were being deceived, but they had this secret coded method that Harry and Bess could communicate with each other in order to sort of demonstrate how psychics may be pulling these scams off. Can you explain the secret coding method?
I think we should touch on that a little bit. I don't want to go into it too much, but here's one way to, and anybody that's interested in this, it's all explained in the essay quite clearly. There's a list of 10 words, and the 10th word is actually a phrase. And each word corresponds to a number, number 1 through 10. And number 10 can also be taken to be 0. And so this was used to point most commonly to the date on a coin. So that's how the trick would normally work when Harry and Bess first met in 1894. That's when they got married. They would do this little trick where they would have someone volunteer. They'd reach in their pocket, pull out a coin. All right, what are the last 2 digits on the coin? And these words, which pray, answer, say, now, tell, and so forth, these words would be correlated to a number. And so they would work these words into an easy sentence, like, quickly, Harry, I know you can do this. And that would be number 8. And so it has a naturalness to it, and yet there's some information in there. You see what I mean?
Right. So if the coin that Bess held in her hand was, let's say, 1888, and because she would say she's communicating to him verbally using these code words, and she said quickly corresponds with the number 8. It's the eighth word in the secret coding method. So then he knew that one of the numbers was 8, right? And then she might use quickly again, so that would be the second number. Right. Makes sense.
Right.
Okay.
And I don't want to go into the details on how it can be used to construct words rather than just numbers. But it can. Now, of course, we have 26 letters in the alphabet, so you got to use a pair of words at times to get to the letters that are past number 10. But they have a way of doing that. And that's what was used to make this code.
So they would have had to memorize, they'd have to memorize
Yes.
those 10 words or phrases. Pray, answer,
Right.
say, now, tell, please, speak, quickly, look, be quick. And as
Yes,
you say,
yes.
all of this can be found in the essay. Let me just give people the website if they want to follow along at home, as we say, infinitelymystical.com. Infinitelymystical.com is the website where Houdini's afterlife experiment, did it work? The essay is posted there. Sorry,
Yeah,
Thomas,
and
go ahead.
There's a link on there, Coast to Coast. Now, let's talk about this code, because after the message was delivered to Beth and she said that it worked, somebody quickly said, hey, this was all in a book. It's all already published in a book. This is no big deal. Well, I thought, and I had read this online a number of times, someone would say it was in a book, but they wouldn't say the name of the book. Other people were saying it's on page da-da-da-da-da, and they wouldn't say the name of the book. It was driving me crazy. And then I finally found someone who said the name of the book, and I thought, you know, I'm going to look in the Santa Barbara County Library and see if that book is there. And I was so surprised to find out that it was in northern Santa Barbara County. And for all of 25 cents, they would move that book down to the downtown Santa Barbara Library, and I could go in there and check it out, an 85-year-old book. I couldn't believe it. So I got the book, and I scanned the relevant pages of this book. And if you're interested, just follow that main essay. There's a link inside there that will show you scans of this book. And so that book does talk about those 10 words and how it's used to form numbers, but not how to form words. So that's not in the book. In fact, there are a number of important things that are not in the book. And let's see. Here I have some bullet points about this, that the code can be used to form words, not just numbers. How the clever coding method works to form these words, that they use this code in the afterlife experiment, that the secret message would start with the unencoded word Rosabelle, that the secret message would encode the word believe, and the actual secret 10-word message. None of that was in the book. And the person who claimed that it was in the book, this is important to ask who this is. He also is a famous magician, and he's a close personal friend of Harry Houdini. So when this person says, it's not a trick, it's in the book, everyone just took him at his word, did not look into the book, and just believed that Ford was a fraud without looking into it anymore.
Okay, we need to back up a little bit, because we need to introduce Ford, and why it was important for you to point out that this secret coded message was sort of explained in another book by Houdini or about Houdini, and therefore it may have been possible for someone to know about that, because now we get into the seance, and we should back up and explain that on Houdini's deathbed in Detroit, one of the last things he told doctors, allegedly, I don't know if this is actually true, but allegedly he told them that, yeah, I'm a skeptic, I'm a debunker, I don't believe in an afterlife, but if there's any way I can get a message to Bess, I will try. And then she is contacted, Bess is, several years later, correct, by an Arthur Ford. How did Ford get in touch with Bess?
Well, I'll touch on that in just a minute, but I just want to point out that I think that this worked because Bess and Harry loved each other so much. I think that's really important to point out. Now, science runs these experiments checking into reality as if it's a heartless machine. And I think it's really important for us to think about how well we love one another and how available we are for kindness and compassion. And we're not involved in a big, giant, heartless machine. So, back to your question. Ford was a reasonably successful psychic, and he had clients that would come to him and ask him questions. And in one of these sessions in 1928, I think it's about 15 months after Harry died, one of his clients is getting a reading, and Harry's mother, the spirit, she had already passed, the spirit of Harry's mother intrudes into the session and insists on putting the word forgive in all capital letters, putting in a letter and sending it to Beth. Well, Beth gets this letter, and she responds in writing, is the understanding I have. And she says, It's too bad this came after Harry died, because this is the word that he was looking for from his mother, to show him that his mother's soul or spirit was surviving death. And so this got her attention. But what's really interesting is that neither Bess Houdini nor Arthur Ford pursued this anymore. They didn't want to pursue. Arthur Ford was well aware of Houdini's reputation and how strongly he was pushing back against the mediums, and he didn't.
Thomas, I got to jump in here. Forgive me, Thomas. I got to jump in. We've got a break coming up. We'll come back and continue to discuss the after-death communication experiment with Harry Houdini and Bess Houdini. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. S-Y because I love you. R-E-double-T. Get on up to the coasttocoastam.com website, and our webmaster tonight, Sean Latasore, has posted some interesting photos of Harry Houdini and Bess Houdini and psychic medium Arthur Ford, and a scan of the written statement Bess Houdini released publicly and through the newspapers after the seance in 1929, stating she genuinely believed she had received a secret coded message from Harry from beyond the grave. These come courtesy of our guest tonight, Thomas Rossetto. More with Thomas Rossetto and Harry Houdini's after-death communication experiment when Coast to Coast AM continues. Thomas Rossetto, my guest, the author of Living the Paradox of Enlightenment and the essay we're discussing, Houdini's Afterlife Experiment, Did It Work? And that is posted up at the coasttocoastam.com website and Thomas's website as well, infinitelymystical.com. Time is tight, Thomas, so let's get to the seance at Bess's house in January of 1929. And Arthur Ford is there. This is the medium who had reached out to her. So what happens?
Arthur Ford shows up, and Arthur Ford usually works with a spirit named Fletcher. And Fletcher is in touch with Houdini, and this ability for the spirit world to communicate to our physical world is a little bit tricky to navigate. And so sometimes spirits need a little more help with this. And apparently Houdini's mother, the spirit of Houdini's mother, was also present to make this all happen. And they were able to make it kind of a, like a show, a very theatrical show, where Harry would work with Bess the same way they worked when they were on stage, and use her as an assistant, and have her, well, he was very poetic with her. He was very, at times, very touching and romantic. And there were statements like throw open the curtain and all of this. But what they did was they put this 10 keywords on the table, and then they decoded them. And after it was decoded, the message, I'll tell it in just a minute, but first I want to explain that Bess's nickname that Harry used for her was Rosabelle. And this came about through a popular song right around the time when they got married. And this song had a little bit, or perhaps more, of this song inside her wedding ring. And so Harry called her Rosabelle. And so the message, once it was decoded, was Rosabelle, believe. And it really, really touched Bess. And she was very, very strong and clear in her language that her husband had spoken to her. And
did Arthur Ford know that Rosabelle was the pet name for Bess, or was this common knowledge?
It might have been known throughout the close friends. So I really can't say about that. There's a story going around that I read just the other day on the internet, because I was trying to brush up on this kind of stuff. Someone said that there was a big romance between Arthur Ford and Bess, who was 20 years older than he, and he saw her wedding ring and saw the inside of it and saw where it said Rosabelle and blah, blah, blah. I just don't find this credible, so I won't go into it. But there are people that say that it's quite possible that they would have known that he referred to it as Rosabelle. But the believe is actually came through the decoding of those other words.
Right. And again, Ford, through his spirit guide, Fletcher, just didn't shout out the word believe. They used this secret coding message that we had mentioned earlier, using those keywords, pray, answer, say, now, tell, please, speak, quickly, look, and be quick. And these all, when decoded, spelled out the message, which began with Rosabelle and believe.
Yes. Yes. And
And she declared this a success. She declared it a success, correct?
Absolutely. And in fact, the very next day, and in fact, I think this was written in another newspaper by someone who was present at the seance, said, "Ah, this is a lot of nonsense. It wasn't true." And so Beth, that's why her statement says, "Regardless of any statements made to the contrary, I wish to declare that the message in its entirety and in the agreed-upon sequence given to me by Arthur Ford is the correct message prearranged between Mr. Houdini and myself." And then it's signed by not only her, but three witnesses. One of them is a representative of the United Press. Another one is one of her lifelong friends. And another one is someone from Scientific American.
And this letter was reprinted in the New York Times, and she gave an interview to the Times again, confirming that this was a success, that it happened.
Yeah, I think so. And in fact, the newspaper articles that I was reading, you could clearly see her in support for a good while. And then around 14 months after this, there's a hard switch where she suddenly starts to denounce that anything was valid, that there was any evidence whatsoever that this was a genuine contact. So it's quite shocking.
But before that, before she sort of recanted, there was another reporter with either a magazine or a newspaper called the New York the New York Graphic.
Yes, yes.
And tell me about this reporter. Is it Juari? I can't pronounce the name, but
I don't know
reporter.
The last name, but I think the first name is Rea, and I think it's pronounced Rea.
Right.
She had an apartment, and she invited Arthur Ford over to visit her, and she was going to interview him. And she had some friends hiding. I don't know whether they're hiding in a closet, but they're hiding somewhere, and they're going to witness this exchange. Well, the person that shows up is not really Arthur Ford. It's someone that's been paid to impersonate Arthur Ford. And he shows up, and he says, "Ah, I paid Mrs. Houdini some money. She gave me the code. I'm just here to tell you the truth." And I just, you know, it's really funny because Beth heard about, the reporter wrote this up. And so Beth responded in a letter to that same paper where she just completely denies that she's been a party of fraud in any way. And if Arthur Ford said that they were in cahoots, he's a liar. I mean, she's very clear in this letter. It goes on. And I had never seen this letter until yesterday. And it's in an article posted on a website, and the author's name is Greg Newkirk.
And this was written to Walter Winchell, the great Walter Winchell.
That's what I thought. I had read that there was a letter written to Walter Winchell, and he was, the social go-to guy, you know. But this kind of made it look like it was a letter written to the New York Evening Graphic. But it doesn't matter. There may have been two letters, but she was very supportive. And these were supposed to be private letters. The letter starts off saying, "This letter is not for publicity. I do not need publicity. You know, I'm just telling you, I was no party to any fraud." You know, but anyway, there's a number of things like this where it looks like someone's saying, "Aha, we've got proof. There's fraud. He confessed." And then it's like, yeah, but that wasn't him. His lawyer said he was somewhere else at the time. So Arthur Ford didn't go to this meeting with this reporter at all.
Right. However, at some point, Bess Houdini further muddies the water, because although she has been insisting that it happened, then she does an abrupt about-face.
Yes. And, you know, in the very first days after the message happened, in one of the newspaper articles, I read something where she says, "Oh, by the way, my family and friends, they don't buy this. You know, they don't believe in spirit communication, you know." And so I think that this festered, and she was tired of being ridiculed by her friends, being labeled a nut. And I think she just folded and said, "You know what, I'm going to go back to my friends. I want them to accept me." And she even said things like, "If anyone says they get in touch with me after my death and know that it's false, I will not try to get in touch with anyone." So this also muddied the water.
And when, I mean, how long after the seance in 29 was she recanting and changing her position?
I think it was about 14 months.
14 months. And but also she had, at some point, she had offered up an award, a reward, a $10,000
yes.
prize to anyone, $10,000. But and then she refused to pay for it. So
that's
was
really interesting, too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if she really was in cahoots with Arthur Ford, he could have done this much more gracefully. She basically said, hey, look, I'm not paying because a couple weeks before this happened, I retracted the offer. Well, that sounds, you know, pretty iffy. Whereas if they were in cahoots, he could have said, I'm so happy that she's so generous, but I don't want my spiritual progress to be hindered by some kind of monetary motivation. You know, it would have been much more graceful. You see what I mean? But it was just days after where she says, I'm not going to pay the money.
Right. So your feelings are that Bess basically, and she herself was an avowed debunker for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And so the social pressure from her family was just too much. And so she caved and she recanted.
Yeah, I think that's what happened. I think the subtitle of my essay says something like that. Does Mrs. Houdini want to be a nut or something like that? It's not on the online version, but anyway, I think she just got tired of arguing with anybody and wanted to be with the people that she'd been with her whole life and be accepted by them. There's also a lot of confusion, and we should touch on this because I think we should go into everything. Arthur Ford himself, shortly after, I think it was about a couple of years after the seance, he was in a really bad car accident. He was with his sister. She dies in this car accident. And his healing process is aided by painkillers, and some of this is morphine. And he becomes addicted to morphine, and he, for the rest of his life, has morphine and alcohol problems. And I think this might have affected his ability to function as a psychic. And much later, near the end of his life, and I'm sorry, I don't have the dates on this, he was involved in a very high-profile seance with Pike. That's the name that comes to mind.
Oh, James Pike. Yes, it was up here in Canada, up on our
Canadian
National Television. There's another Canadian connection, yes.
Yes, yeah. And I think it's in, I'm looking at it now, 1967. Ford
yes.
held a seance for Pike. Now, Pike's son had tragically committed suicide the year before. Now, what Ford did for this high-profile seance was he did what all the fakers do. He researched the story ahead of time, found some tidbits.
You're kind of breaking up on us, Thomas. I'm not sure if it's your cordless phone or a cell phone, but maybe if you keep very still and speak, maybe.
Okay.
There we are.
It's actually a voice-over IP line, and sometimes it does break up. Is that a little better?
It is.
Okay.
Okay, so James Pike, this is an Episcopal bishop. His son had committed suicide a year earlier, and now Ford is doing a seance on Canadian television.
Yes, and he does a little upfront research, brings it into the seance as if he's getting it in a psychic way, whereas in fact he got it from a conventional way. This was discovered after Ford died, and people went through his papers and found his research preparing for this seance, and that's why people say this. So this is another black mark against Arthur Ford. And it, again, muddies the water. So this case, the Houdini case, as fun as it is and as exciting as it is, it's not going to be the first breakthrough, convince all the hard-nosed skeptics. It just isn't.
Right. But okay, so Ford is discredited because of the seance in Canada in 1967. But as you point out, he had been taking morphine, he had been drinking.
Yes.
Perhaps that had damaged his medium abilities. Does that necessarily discredit the work that he did on the Houdini case?
Yes, yes. That's the way I see it.
That it does or it doesn't?
I think that it puts a cloud over it, but it doesn't necessarily directly bear on it.
Now, despite Bess's recanting, and, you know, saying, no, I don't believe that Harry communicated with me, nor could he. Then why did she continue to do these seances, high-profile public seances, on the anniversary of Harry's death for the next 10 years?
She did it for 10 years after his death, but she didn't start them until a couple of years into that. So she did about 7 of them is my count. But the point is still well taken. And here's the way I look at it. When she was with Harry, she would be on stage at times, and Harry was the one in the spotlight. But when Harry dies, she's in the spotlight, but she doesn't have anything to do. You know, and so all of a sudden, she's in an unusual place. And so by stepping into the spotlight only once a year for one night to do these seances, and I think the last one was in L.A., on the top of a building, you know, at first they were going to do it down in the building, but then they said, let's do it up on the top where we'll be higher, closer to God and the spirits. Anyway, I think she knew these were going to be a failure because she was the one that was acting as the medium, and she's not a medium, so you've pretty much guaranteed they're going to fail. So she can say that statement at the end, you know, 10 years is long enough to wait for any man and that kind of thing. And it kind of makes it safe for her to say, well, I tried. I'm open-minded. I tried, but it didn't work. And so I'm going to go back with my friends and embrace the standard mainstream belief.
But you're inclined to believe that the original statement released in the New York Times in 1929, affirming that she had been contacted through Arthur Ford, been contacted by her beloved Harry, that quite possibly happened.
Yes, yes, I do. And the other letter that she wrote to Winchell is also, it has a fair amount of passion to it. She's very strong, you know? And so now someone would say, well, if she was tricked and didn't know she was tricked, she would still feel very strongly. So I'm open-minded to that comment too.
You finish the essay with, I don't know if you have it in front of you, and if you could share with us the final words of Harry Houdini as brought forth by Fletcher and Ford, Fletcher being the spirit guide and Ford at the end of that successful session. Can you share those words as we head into the break?
Sure. And this is the words of Harry. So it's, tell the whole world that Harry Houdini still lives, and he will prove it 1,000 times and more. In my life, I was perfectly honest and sincere in trying to disprove the survival of consciousness, and I resorted to tricks to prove my point for the simple reason that I did not believe communication was possible. I am now sincere in my desire to undo this mistake. Tell all those who lost faith because of my mistake to lay hold again of hope and to live with the knowledge that life is continuous. That is my message to the world through my wife and through this psychic medium. So those are the words.
Fantastic. Thomas, how do people get a hold of Living the Paradox of Enlightenment?
Amazon.com. There's both a paperback and an ebook. And I do want to point out one interesting thing. Dr. Gary Swartz wrote the book, The Afterlife Experiments, and he was a guest with Art Bell all those years ago. And I have recently heard that Gary Swartz has Harry Houdini as a spirit that he's been working with over there at the University of Arizona.
How about fascinating. That's fantastic. Well, we'll have to get Dr. Schwartz on the program again and follow up.
Yeah,
well, Thomas,
yes.
Thank you so much for this.
Well, Richard, you're an excellent host. You have a good heart, and the work you do is making the world a better place, and I appreciate it.
All right, God bless, and thank you. Thomas Rossetto. When we come back, who murdered FDR? You heard me correctly. Who murdered FDR?